Warning. Contains scenes which some may find upsetting, including scenes of violence. Africa Eye. Crime Scene Audio. The date is 15th of July 1987. The time is 0100 hours. There's a lock that has been forced open. Black male lying in the doorway. There's two holes visible in the torso.
Holes visible in the torso.
Lying on the floor, two spent cartridges, which was fired by Mr. Van Skuer. Grey clouds loom over a long stretch of road that's flanked by fields and dense woodland. Looking into a bedroom at a window, with blinds that are too narrow for its frame. Below the windowsill, a stain runs along the wall. Yeah. A man with stumps for legs is lying face down on a single bed. He lifts up his left stump, which extends past his knee, before lifting up the right one, which is shorter. He's a scruffy white man in his 70s, with a thick, greying beard.
I had
a heart attack a couple of years ago, and unfortunately, I picked up problems with my legs.
With the left one, they gave me an epidural, but you only numbed from the hips down.
The man's longer stump has a bandage on the end.
I was half awake, half asleep when they did the left one. With the right one, I said to the anaesthetist, I want to be awake during this operation. It was a weird feeling because I lay there and I didn't feel them cutting. But I could feel the jerking as they sawed through the bone. I said to the surgeon that was operating, I said, hey, you must get a new saw because that one's blunt. He just laughed.
You think the more you do it, the easier it gets. But it doesn't.
You know, they carried on, he sawed the bone, and then when he started stitching, well, they don't stitch, they put clips in. I could feel him pulling the skin, getting it tight. But before that, they got, it's like an electric soldering iron, which they burn the nerves and the main arteries, they burn it to close it and so forth. And you could smell meat burning.
I said to myself, what shall be, and I won't give up.
Yeah.
It may take me a little bit longer, but I will carry on.
The man gets into a wheelchair that's beside his bed. He lives in the countryside in a small, white, single-story house. With daylight fading, he sits in his garden, struggling to maneuver his wheelchair.
I don't have sleepless nights. I don't have things coming up in the past haunting me. Louis van Skuer is a negative figure. He's brutal. He's cruel, he's merciless, serial killer. But I was a crime fighter. And if you're successful, then you're going to be called monsters and serial killer and whatever you want to, which I don't agree with.
He strokes his black dog.
Look, I got nothing against the opposite race. All the people that I shot were blacks. That's not because of race. It was because of crime. I used a semi-automatic 9mm pistol.
I used maximum force. They were justifiable homicide. And that's the bottom line.
The man stares out of his bedroom window towards some distant hills. Foreboding clouds fill the sky and drift across the landscape. In bold white letters on black, the Apartheid Killer. Archive footage showing a raging fire and a burnt-out shop with smashed windows.
It's really important that we look at the past in this country, that we dig deep into all of the occurrences during the apartheid era and try and bring it into the light.
A white man with a megaphone addressing a black crowd.
Apartheid means separation, being separate. White, blacks were all separated. But ultimately, the losers were black people. Pushed into areas through forced removals, kilometers and kilometers and kilometers away from any kind of economic hub where they might have any hope of finding a job. And the winners were white people who benefited massively from this entire policy, which was set up to dispossess black people.
A black man being beaten by police.
The apartheid government operated violently, very violently. Black people were disappearing during apartheid. Black people were being murdered with impunity. There are an inordinate amount of apartheid era killers who have walked free, and they will never ever be punished.
A soldier throws something from an armored vehicle. Journalist Isa Jacobson, a middle-aged white woman with short dark hair.
I've been working on the Van Schoor case for more than 20 years. He certainly is one of the most prolific killers in South Africa to this day. And I have been looking for evidence of more shootings and killings, because the rumour was that Van Schoor had shot over 100 black men and boys.
Hi. We're trying to look for the location of a place where a murder took place. So we're trying to see if there's a wall like this. This could be it.
I don't know. You can ask the manager. I'm not sure.
Okay. Where's the manager?
A white man.
Did you hear about this at all? I mean, did you know that there'd been a killing on the road, or...?
I heard about Louis Van Schoor, but I've never ever sort of went into the deep details about
it. Yeah. It was a bit of a hunting ground of his. Hot spot, he would call it.
So this, the image that you showed me, there it is right there.
Oh, okay.
That's the exact spot. It's literally identical. Mm.
Wow, thank you. I mean, we'd never have got in here otherwise.
You know, it's stuff you've seen on TV. Mm. You know, when you see it in real life, it's like, gee, I know this place. Gives you goosebumps, doesn't it?
Mm.
That someone so prolific was, yeah.
39-year-old Sebrand Louis Van Schoor has been found guilty in the East London Supreme Court on 7 counts of murder and 2 of attempted murder. Initially, the accused faced a total of 43 charges, 19 of murder, 21 of attempted murder and 3 of assault. During the 8-month trial, the state withdrew 11 of the attempted murder charges and dropped all the assault charges.
Footage of Van Schoor as a younger man, outside court with his legal team. ISIS driving.
They were biased towards him. It was essentially a country governed by apartheid laws. And everybody in the justice system who could adjudicate were white. He walked free after 12 years in prison.
She walks up to a fast food restaurant that's in an old photo she's holding and looks through the window. The restaurant's closed.
Louis van Schoor was a security guard guarding white-owned businesses. He had these special alarms, and alarms usually make a sound, but his was silent. And so that meant he could surprise any intruder. They would not know he was coming. These were intruders who were, in a lot of cases, pretty desperate. Digging through bins, maybe stealing some food, maybe some clothing, you know, petty criminals. Some were even children. He was a kind of vigilante killer. He was a Dirty Harry character, you know, this great savior of the white community. Every single one of the killings that we know of were black people.
At night, a small brick house with a satellite dish. A bearded black man in a beanie hat goes through a gate before walking to a shed, opening the door and looking in. A group of young black people with their faces blurred are sitting in a circle smoking a hookah pipe. One person's blowing smoke rings. In the daytime, the bearded black man looks into the camera.
My name is Raymond. I'm 41 years old now. My father's name is Edward Sunis. I was 6 years at the time that I lost my father.
I didn't get the love that a mother and father must give you. This was very hard for me. I was struggling. I must be a father and a mother to myself.
A father and a mother to myself.
Raymond sucks on the hookah pipe's hose and blows out smoke towards us. The smoke swirls in the air.
Nobody was there for me.
I am a nobody, so no one explained to me what happened. A stray dog crossing an empty street, then Raymond doing the same. He says, later we saw in the newspapers that van Schoor had shot my father. He stops to let a van pass, then keeps on walking.
I was very scared, and I didn't know what to do.
He's playing pool in a bar. Then I got involved in gang violence. We began fighting and stabbing with knives. He's walking along an empty street, carrying a bottle of beer. Growing up, I was very angry at van Schoor because he shot and killed my father. And I was always so angry. I thought that if I could get my hands on him, I would stab him to death. He sits down and swigs from his bottle. After my dad died, I changed. I wasn't the same person anymore because of the anger that I carried in my heart. Raymond up close, looking sad and reflective. Flying over a city that's filled with traffic. A car's driving slowly down a coastal road towards the restaurant Isa visited earlier. Sitting in the back seat, van Schoor points out the window.
This building on the left here, that used to be a hot spot. This shop here on the corner was a hot spot. I shot, I think, two guys there. Yeah. The Beach Burger used to be in this building, and they made the best chicken rolls, mayonnaise chicken rolls. Fantastic. In the beginning of my reign, the crime rate dropped drastically. When the political situation in the country changed, Nelson Mandela became the first black president of South Africa. Crime just started getting worse and worse.
Two black men on a corner, putting pieces of cardboard in a shopping trolley.
Now,
you dare not walk up Oxford Street. You're going to be robbed. There's no two ways about it. Go look at the court records. It's mostly blacks.
It's mostly blacks. I mean, look at you.
I mean, look over here. How many whites can you spot here? One, two, three.
Three.
They drive past a corner where a crowd of mostly black people are waiting. In the early evening, a traffic light changes from red to green.
Every night's a new night. It's a new adventure. You work out a pattern for your different crimes. And that was exciting. You can draw a visual of what's going to happen tonight, where it's going to happen tonight. The alarm went off at that factory shop. I'd never drive straight up and stop in front of the shop. I'd stop two or three businesses away with night binoculars and then walk down. I normally work barefoot, quiet.
I relied a lot on my nose sense.
If somebody breaks in, their adrenaline gives off an odour and you can pick that up. You switched on, you on maximum alert.
You sort of get that feeling that yes, hunting but a different species. From meat being cooked on a barbecue to a series of black and white crime scene photos. They show the blurred bodies of several black men still lying where they were killed. In one photo, Van Skoor is standing over a body, pointing to two different spots. In another photo, he's outside pointing into a bush, where another body's lying. Now wearing a baseball cap, Raymond looks down as a tear slowly rolls down his cheek. He wipes his eyes with his hand. He says, "When my father went missing, I was 6 years old." I would sit outside and wait until it was dusk. I waited for him to come home. My grandmother said, "Don't worry, your father always comes." But I felt in my heart that something was wrong. Raymond's lying on his side in bed. I found out after 2 years that my father had died. He was killed by Van Skoor. His window looks out towards a wooded mountain. He says, "Sometimes I have visions, and I see the way Van Skoor killed him."
The way Van Skoor him to it.
When I think about it, it breaks my heart. Clothes are piled up in a corner of the room. Sometimes I sit down and the tears just fall because my heart is broken from the pain I feel. Leaning forwards, he wipes his eyes with his hand. My dad loved me very much. He was always smiling. When I remember those things, it's heartbreaking.
In
Wiping his eyes, he says, I won't forget him. He wipes away the tears with the back of his sleeve and says, it's always there in your heart. A plump black woman with a headscarf is walking through a sunlit cemetery.
Edward is my brother, I am his sister. Edward was killed in 1987 by a man called Louis van Schoor. When we heard about Edward's death, he was already buried in an unmarked grave. It was devastating for the family. We couldn't get his remains.
We believe that his spirit is roaming around here and is looking for home. He's not with his ancestors.
He doesn't know where he is. He's not resting in peace.
He's sitting somewhere, maybe watching.
The woman has stopped and is staring down at his unmarked grave.
It feels like we failed, Edward.
We have been fighting for 13 years for Edward's bones to be exhumed and buried back home. The woman's pulling up clumps of grass. A golden sun peeking over a row of nearby houses. Then the woman with her arms crossed, staring down at the grave. We tried many times to get help from government officials, but we didn't have the money to rebury him. The woman stares off, with the setting sun behind her.
If we could succeed in bringing him home, it would help heal us. We want Raymond to have a place to point that his dad is somewhere. A place that would heal our hearts. A place where we can say, here lies Edward Souness.
Staring into a field, the woman leans on a fence, resting her hands on a length of barbed wire. A sea of rooftops in a densely populated township. A middle-aged black man leaning on the counter in a shop. He says, Van Schoor was a killer. He really killed people, that person.
I still remember. So many. We know them by names. They killed
people, but nothing happened. Joe is my nickname. Tetineni Wordsworth Sipo Jordan.
Tetineni Wordsworth Sipo Jordan.
In archive footage, a large crowd of black protesters marching.
At that time,
I was busy operating very clandestinely for the African National Congress, the opposition party of the apartheid regime, which was banned. White officers using dogs to drive back the crowd.
We fought for this country because we wanted people of this country to be liberated, to be free. Not a section of the population, but the entire country. We paid through our blood. We shed our blood.
Footage showing a black man who's been beaten up. He has a large blood stain on his shoulder and a bloodied ear. Another black man is laid on a stretcher. A thick plume of smoke rises up in the distance. In his shop, Joe's arranging items on the counter.
Francois was highly protected, because he was working with the police, and police didn't have any problem with what he was doing. He never got arrested because he was the one who phones the police. There will be no case open, no inquest, nothing. Bah, bah, bah. Nothing happened. He reached such a stage where he was now hunting people. This is an animal. It's not a human being. He was known to be a killer. He was known to be a killer. Even if you see him in the town, everybody will say, here's the killer, here's the killer, here's the killer.
Wheeling himself along, Van Skoor stares down towards the sea. On the rocky beach below, two black men are filling bottles with seawater.
That fresh sea air, actually makes me want to come back to East London.
He stares out to sea. Then he's talking to a young black man. The man, who's bald and barefooted, asks, where do I know you from? Where have I seen you?
Where am I from?
Where do I know you from?
I don't know. I don't recognize you.
Why is your face so familiar?
Maybe because I'm a popular guy.
Then who is the popular guy? I need to know. I want to know the popular guy.
Why do you want to know who I am?
Because
I won't rest until I know and understand. Where did I see you from?
Where did I see you from?
Van Skoor just stares at him, with a cigarette between his fingers.
I'm just an ordinary person.
What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of nothing.
Then,
but why must I give my information to somebody that I don't know? Somebody that I got no connection with?
Now that you didn't know me, you get the chance to know me.
Van Skoor holds out his hand, and the young black man takes hold of it.
My name is Van Skoor.
The man nods and asks, is that your last name or your name?
My last name. Don't worry about my first name. My surname is Van Skoor.
Van Skoor laughs as the man walks away. He shakes his head, then looks around. A man and a woman, both black, are sitting on the beach.
I suppose if I gave him
my first name, he would have clicked more. But he can go and do some research.
yeah. Interesting. Maybe the public want me to apologize. But I'm not going to make a mockery of my own belief. And just to please them.
Waves crashing onto rocks.
I can tell you, yes, I've got remorse, I feel sorry and all that. But I can't, because I've got no remorse inside. Because I don't feel that I was wrong.
He stares out to sea, with his longer stump resting on a low wall in front of him. A girl cycling down a residential street, and a black dog barking behind a mesh wire fence. A white woman in her 40s is sitting on her sofa with her mixed-race daughter on her lap.
Here's the monster. Here's the monster.
The girl and her sister are colouring in with their black father.
My family is based on love. I want my children to know they love. I want them to know that their father loves them more than anything. I want them to know that I love them more than anything.
And I'm a sister coming, Daddy.
Their father says, I want a lot for them. Finish school, go to college, travel the world. If they have to go to the moon too, it's fine. I will love that.
I will try and give them everything.
I will try and give them everything I have. I don't want people to hate my kids because of what their grandfather did. Go to school and they're going to get bullied because of what their grandfather did. The woman takes some old photographs out of an envelope and lays them out on the bed she's sitting on. Studying the photos, she takes a deep breath.
That's me. All the little ones are me. I remember the ones with my father because I was always very close to him when I was young. And I know my father as being firm and being strict.
Her father is Louis van Schoor. A photo shows him hugging her in a swimming pool.
As a child growing up, we were never told, I love you. We were never shown emotion because I don't think he knows how to show that emotion. My father was raised very harshly. It was an all-white neighborhood. The whites didn't mix with a different race. They could come and clean your house and go. That's it.
A black maid vacuuming.
His childhood, his friends, his family, the people he worked for. They weren't raised to see a black person as a human being. It's the same with Hitler, the Nazis. They indoctrinated children from a young age. If your skin was dark, you're a criminal. What my dad did was motivated by white society. He had the whole police force, the whole legal community. He had everyone behind him. When he shot someone, they would say, "Well done, Louis, good job. Keep up the good work," you know. It made him think that what he was doing is right. They had "I love Louis" bumper stickers, and the heart would have a bullet hole through. They enjoyed what he was doing. All of the murders were signed off as justifiable. My father was a serial killer, but the law enforcement was backing him. The judicial system was backing him. He's not the only person to blame for those murders.
Footage of white police officers carrying rifles. In an apartment at night, journalist Isis on her laptop.
Before becoming a security guard, van Schoor had been a policeman for more than a decade. He represents the psychology of apartheid.
We are asking you people to disperse. If I'm gonna stand.
Black people, black bodies were essentially dehumanized. This unknown, unnamed threat. It was about enforcing racism. It was used to break up riots, to break up any form of resistance to apartheid.
You people, let's get out now very quickly, okay? Because you people are the cause of this now. So get out.
He was part of the dog squad, a terrifying unit of the police force in South Africa. They had Alsatian dogs that they would set on people. And they didn't really care what those dogs did.
Footage of a black man being mauled by an Alsatian while a group of police officers watch. Isis watching the video on her laptop. The man screams, "Let me go, boss. Please, let me go, boss.
I think a lot of those guys really enjoyed what they did. I think that they got a kick out of it. Because, essentially, they could do what they wanted, you know. They could operate on their own and get away with it.
The footage shows an officer throwing a stone at a man he's just stomped on and kicked in the head.
That period, that unit, that would have formed him. South Africa created him.
A car driving slowly under a bridge. Joe's in the back seat, wearing a white baseball cap. He says, that's the Cambridge police station.
This was the most
hostile police station in this part of the region.
In this part of the region. Feared.
Nobody wanted to be arrested and be taken to Cambridge police station. Joe stares out through his window, which is dotted with raindrops.
Ruthless.
He says, ruthless. The toughest time if you get arrested is when you go for interrogation.
If you get arrested, it's when you go for interrogation.
I was immediately taken to the cells. And after close to 2 hours, they opened the door again and they called, hey Joe, come on, it's your turn.
And I called, hey Joe, come on, it's your turn. There was a bench
next to the wall on that cell. And this guy said, strip, 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 strip. And I stripped. And I was left with underwear.
And I was left with underwear. And he said,
when you go to bed with your girlfriend, do you usually leave on your underpants? I asked him, where's my girlfriend? He said, here is your girlfriend. And he showed me the bench. And when I looked at this bench, there were belts attached to the bench itself.
The bench itself.
And they put my hands under the bench, and they put handcuffs, and they put the belts right from down there, and I was unable to move except only the head.
Down there, and I was unable to move except only the head. There was a guy
who was wearing some military boots, a sweatband with a military vest.
With a military vest.
He said he's employed to make sure that sick people from the ANC are treated well. So I'm going to treat you. He came on my back with boots, military boots. He was jumping on my back up and down. Up and down.
Up and down. Up and down.
They broke my back. That's the most painful. Most painful. And they said, no, he's not responding. They took a stick, and I was... My feet were just like that because I was on the bench, lying on my stomach, like this.
Because I was in a bench, lying on my stomach like this.
They took a stick and beat me underneath. Until I was unable to count even how many lashes.
Unable to count even how many lashes. And
that was the last time I remember what happened.
I remember what happened.
You could see that these guys work as a team. All criminal police were there. Cambridge Police Station was known for killing.
They don't want
to investigate cases. They choose friends.
They cover
for certain individuals. Someone is covering up the whole thing. At night, headlights pass by in the distance. as flashes of lightning illuminate the sky.
Cambridge Police Station. That's where a lot of these unsquare cases were being reported. It's also the place where a lot of tortures were taking place.
He would not have been able to get away with it without the help of the police force in East London.
Rows of shelving units filled with boxes.
The reason why I knew that there were case files was because I'd seen them myself and then they disappeared.
Within these boxes, each one contains multiple killings and shootings.
Stacks of case files from 1991.
The scale of Van Schoor's reign of terror has not actually been fully investigated.
Isa's on a laptop, counting a list of acquittals.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. Then, according to other records, there were another 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. He was convicted for only 7 counts of murder and 2 of attempted murder. But we know that he was responsible for 41 acts of killing. This is Edward Sunnis's file, and you can see there's evidence missing. I mean, there are no photographs of Edward alive or dead. And this is the only representation we have of him. 2 bullet wounds. Van Schoor would radio in that killing to the police. In many instances, we know that the police arrived very soon after the killing. They would take a quick look and essentially rubber stamp these as justifiable homicide.
No real genuine investigation was ever performed.
It seems to me that whoever arrived on the scene was not trying to do their job. And so what does that really mean? That, you know, they were intentionally covering up for Van Schoor? Were they friends with him? Did they see something wrong that they didn't want to report and so conveniently decide not to take photographs? I mean, all in all, it amounts to collusion. We know that Van Schoor was not tried for at least 20 killings. The apartheid state essentially gave him a license to kill.
I was welcome at Cambridge Police Station. I got a lot of information from the police. I gave a lot of information to the police.
Police officers wearing riot helmets and carrying leather whips.
Every officer in East London knew what was going on. Because just about every shooting, an officer has to attend the scene. And not once did anybody say to me, hey, Louis, you're under the borderline. You must cool it or step it aside or whatever the case may be. Every shooting was documented. The CID who investigated the scene had to write a report. That report goes to the station commander. From the station commander, it goes to the divisional commissioner. It wasn't the Wild West where you just go and shoot somebody, put him in a coffin and go and bury him somewhere.
After I shot somebody, those guys were taken to the mortuary by the police.
But no policeman or police officer was charged to anything relating to my case. What happened to them? Why weren't those investigations done properly? They all knew what was happening. But to save their own skins, I didn't know.
Van Skoor is being driven along on a rain-slicked road that's thick with fog.
Due to the
shift in the political situation of our country, there had to be a scapegoat somewhere. And they picked me.
For all those years, it was right. And then all of a sudden, it's wrong.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
It was difficult to accept that change. We could basically read the writing on the wall that the blacks are going to become part of society.
Addressing the black crowd, Mandela says, "Fellow South Africans, I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy, and freedom for all."
Democracy and freedom for all!
The crowd throw their arms up in unison. In the back of the car, Van Skoor says, slowly, while pointing out the window.
Yeah.
After I sold my business, I basically retired and bought this small holding.
I was arrested there. I was out on bail. I went through to town to go and sign for my bail condition. While I was there at the police station, they broke the back window and then they threw a petrol bomb into the main bedroom. By the time I got there, there was nothing left. Everything inside was destroyed. The police did an investigation and so forth, but up until today, we don't know who the actual people were.
I lost everything. Everything.
Everything.
A lot of guys stabbed me in the back.
I went to prison and I said they will not break me.
I can't remember how long after that. Friends of mine called me and said they've just arrested Sabrina. And they wanted to tell me before it came on the news.
Sabrina's two daughters are helping her prepare dinner.
Then you're going to eat the dirty one. For me, it feels like the Van Skoor family has been cursed. With my father having gone to prison, and then me following in his footsteps, it was like a curse for me because I was so afraid that it would happen to my children as well.
She's slicing onions.
It's 1 o'clock. I'm Shadley Nash with the latest news. A prominent Queenstown businesswoman has been found stabbed to death in a home. In a surprising twist in the murder of Queenstown businesswoman Beverly Van Skoor, police have arrested a daughter in connection with her death.
An Eastern Cape woman who hired two men to murder her mother because she disapproved of her black friends will be sentenced in the Grahamstown High Court today.
I hired someone to murder my mother. And I called it off twice before it actually happened. And the day I actually collected him myself from the graveyard to bring him to the house. And I led him into our house while my daughter was sleeping. And I took my daughter from my mother and I put her in my room. And I locked us in the room and he went to my mother's room and he murdered her. And then he left, and when he left, that's when I found the police.
Crime scene photos.
Sabrina Van Skoor testified she helped to kill her mother because she was a racist.
22-year-old Sabrina van Schoor was sentenced to 25 years at the Grahamstown High Court.
A pink top, heavily stained with blood. Her partner says, I didn't think she was going to be the one that would murder her own mom. It's very hard to actually tell you.
I know
what she did was totally wrong, but it's my child's mother, you know.
It's my child's mother, you know.
I often think of how differently life would have turned out, not for me, but for my family, my brothers, their children, my children. I often know that I robbed my children of a grandmother. They often ask me, where's Granny Bev? And I can't explain to them.
Take off the other one.
If I could take it back, I would, in a heartbeat.
Sabrina hugs one of her daughters.
I know that there is a big difference between me and my father. I know what I did was wrong. I have asked for forgiveness from everyone, whereas my father doesn't feel like he needs to apologize, because he doesn't feel anything. He doesn't feel the pain. He just wants to believe what he did was right.
A photo of the two of them, taken when Sabrina was a young woman.
The irony of the van Schoor murders is that Sabrina went to prison for almost the same amount of time as her father, for killing one white woman, when her father was responsible for killing more than 30 black men and boys.
Isa's driving round a bend.
Masuni's family couldn't afford to have Edward's remains exhumed and reburied. And I desperately wanted to help them to do this. And I found someone who could. Her name is Charlene Craige. She was part of a team who helped to get van Schoor stopped and put behind bars.
Isa video calls a white woman while sitting with the black woman who visited the cemetery earlier.
Hey.
Hey.
Hello.
Oh, sorry, you need to see Marlene.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
And I'm so glad that I've actually seen you. Now at least when I think of you, I'll have a picture of you. We wouldn't have imagined that one day, after 35 years, we're going to bury Edward. But now, through your funding and through Isa, we have hope. And I'm sure many families, this is going to give them hope that their prayers, too, will be answered.
I'm very pleased, Bonnie. Very pleased.
What happened to Edward affected Raymond's life a lot. Growing up, he was very angry all the time, because he didn't know where his father was. And then came the word that his father was actually dead. It gave him a little bit of peace that he was not abandoned.
I didn't know that about him. And I didn't, to think that there was a little boy that thought he'd been abandoned by his father, you know, and he hadn't been. And I can't even imagine what he went through at that age. And I had no idea about that. And now I'm just wondering how many other stories there are like that with the other victims that we'll never know about, and how many family members or children would have been affected. There's a lot more that we'll never, ever know. You know, that's the part I'm really struggling with at the moment. All the stuff we'll never know.
It's done a lot of damage to families.
A wooded mountain looms over a lonely stretch of road. In a forest, fern leaves swaying in the breeze and a gently flowing river. Raymond's walking through the forest with Thug Life printed on the back of his jumper. He says, I was very heartbroken after my dad died. I would run to the river and sit and find peace. He sits on a rock in the river, watching the water flow. I would sit there, and it would clear my mind. I think if I bring my dad's bones home, his spirit will dance again. He's not happy where he is, but I will bring him home now. In the cemetery Marlene was in earlier, an excavator starts digging up Edward's unmarked grave. It's being directed by a black man with red gloves and a face mask. The man watches closely as the machine digs deeper. A strong wind's blowing through the overgrown grass. The machine piles up soil next to the grave. It's being operated by a black man who's controlling it with two levers. Marlene's watching in a face mask with her hands over her mouth.
Edward.
She says, Edward, my brother, I can feel that you're still here.
Oof.
I can feel you through the wind. Raymond's watching too in a white protective suit and a face mask that's pulled down under his chin. I know that your spirit is roaming around, searching for peace. We did not forget you, Edward. I promise, as your sister, that we are bringing you home. We will always love you. A black man in gloves and a protective suit is standing in the grave. He feels around in the wet earth and finds a human bone from a leg or an arm. He passes it out to someone. Raymond's leaning forwards, staring into the grave. Marlene's turned away from it and is sitting on the grass sobbing. She gets up and walks away, overwhelmed with emotion. She stops after a few meters and sits down again. The man in the grave is now digging through the earth with a shovel. He finds what looks like a human jawbone and passes it out to someone. A man in a Zulu headband is hugging a tearful Raymond. Raymond wipes tears from his eyes as the man pats him on the shoulder. Now they've exhumed a human skull. Marlene's still sitting on the grass, her face screwed up with pain. She breaks down again, covering her face with her hand. Looking down into the grave as the man inside continues digging with his hand. A body bag filled with Edward's remains is laid in a wooden coffin. As the coffin lid is put on, a woman sits down next to Raymond and comforts him. He's leaning forward, crying into his sleeve. The coffin is carried away, with Edward's family following. Raymond still crying with one hand over his face. Archive footage of a black woman weeping and a coffin being carried by a crowd of black South Africans.
There's a lot of pain in this country. I think we feel it the whole time. Trauma from apartheid-era South Africa.
A black man cries uncontrollably while walking towards the camera.
These dead bodies, they were human beings with lives ahead of them.
More coffins being carried.
As white South Africans, there needs to be some reckoning. Van Schoor was a serial killer. But he was a serial killer because there was a system that allowed him to be one.
And there are so many people like him, walking free, apartheid-era killers, torturers, who are leading normal lives.
A white man fires a rifle from an armoured military vehicle. A car driving slowly down a straight road flanked by fields. Mountains loom on the horizon and grey clouds fill the sky. Isa is at the wheel.
I do want to have the opportunity to say what I feel to his face.
Van Schoor's at home, smoking a cigarette.
To see if I can extract any humanity out of the guy and any more truth. There are victims whose lives were taken by him. And if he was more truthful, it might help them.
Isis parked up.
One of the reasons why he was willing to talk to me is because I'm a white South African, because he feels safe with me. And I want him to know that he shouldn't feel safe with me any longer.
Isa goes through Van Schoor's front gate and closes it behind her. His black dog walks with her, wagging its tail, as she makes her way to the front door with a bag on her shoulder. She pulls open the barred door, which is covered in rust, then goes in, leaving the dog outside. Now she's sitting on Van Schoor's sofa, watching him look through crime scene photos.
I can't say I feel anything, because I don't.
Isa nods sternly.
It's a horror show.
It's a what?
Horror show. It's a bloodbath. This is a 12-year-old.
Yeah, well, he looks much different lying there than what he was at night.
Do you remember describing to a journalist that you had shot over 100 people?
Never came out of my mouth. I was charged for what? 43 or 44, 46 counts of murder?
So there were 19 of murder, 21 of attempted murder, and 3 of assault.
Yeah.
Would you say you're responsible for more murders than that?
No.
Because you're naming bigger numbers.
I'm naming bigger numbers?
Yeah.
Where?
You said 40-something counts.
Well, in the counts of murder, I wasn't 100% sure how many was on my charge sheet. I honestly don't know how many I shot, okay? Each shooting of mine went to the police. Each and every one. There are no other shootings that happened where the police weren't informed or that was hidden away.
Because the police were complicit?
No, my dear. You're trying to look for sensation, and I'm telling you straight out. The evidence I had given is what I stay by. There are no outside shootings. All my shootings went to the police.
Well, I happen to know at least one, and I can cite a few more from the Black Sash records where you weren't charged. Shootings that are on record as having been attributed to you. A lot of evidence went missing. And in the end...
No, you can't tell me a lot of evidence went missing. It's not my fault. Once a scene is handed over to the police,
It's their problem. It's their duty.
Your job was not to kill. Your job was to apprehend. You are a serial killer, you know. These are serial killings.
You're stepping over the line now. Never have I been proven by court a serial killer. Not a serial killer.
You know what? In the end, there are a pile of bodies. A pile of bodies attributed to you. Many of those families have never recovered from the deaths of their loved ones. And that's what you're left with. That is your legacy. That is your legacy.
I don't feel guilty about it. If you or anybody else wants to say that I'm wrong, it's your prerogative.
Is there nowhere in you that feels some shame at all for this, for these atrocities?
I'm sorry, no.
They stare at each other for several moments. Van Skoor is sitting with his fingers interlocked.
How do you want people to remember me?
A peaceful, loving, caring person. I just want to be known as Louis van Skoor.
A tree standing alone in the middle of a field, under an overcast sky. In a cemetery, Raymond is digging a grave. He says, "My father comes in my dreams. I see the spirit of my father was there.
The spirit of my father was there.
And he was happy.
And he was happy." He showed me that, my son, I love you. I'm free now.
The sun's shining down as he carries on digging.
My father,
he cared for me. He wanted to do the best thing for his son. A man helps Raymond lay down the base of a gravestone. It says, "Rest easy, sadly missed."
But
he was not rested in the right way. So I was fighting for him, to bury him in a nice way. They install the gravestone, which says, "Here lies a loving father and brother."
And I know now I can go and talk to him.
Raymond stands staring at the gravestone while the golden sun sets behind clouds. Raymond's one of the pallbearers as Edward's coffin is carried towards his grave. Today I bury my father after 35 years.
After 35 years.
We are here this morning, praise the name of the Lord, because Edward was never afforded an opportunity like this.
This is the time now to say, "My father, you are home." I'm bringing him home today. Everybody in the family is with him now. He's free. And also, I'm free now.
And also, I'm free now.
The coffin is slowly lowered into the grave.
Here we are, hallelujah. And here we have this tombstone this morning. And this tombstone will tell us, but here is Edward, hallelujah. And it will tell us we must remember what happened, hallelujah. To him, praise the name of the Lord. Hallelujah.
I'm the proudest guy in the world. And I have peace now.
Raymond tosses a handful of soil into the grave. The rest of the mourners then do the same.
We should rejoice. We should cry happy tears.
Marlene singing happily. Raymond and another man start filling in the grave.
We are rejoicing. Van Schoor has taken nothing from us, because we're getting Edward back. A father, a brother, a good man is coming home.
Raymond gets emotional. Evening sunshine filtering through a tree. Marlene sitting in a field with a serene smile on her face.
I have so much joy in my heart. So much joy, so much peace. And also lots of love. I don't think Van Schoor knows anything about that. We never felt the warmth. He's like an empty shell. He doesn't have a heart.
Sabrina and her partner with their mixed-race daughters.
He doesn't know anything about family.
Sabrina and her partner smile as they watch their daughters play.
The present generation are a product of grief. There's never been an attempt to mend those families.
Joe stares out to sea.
When you have done
something bad to somebody else, you know to say, I'm sorry. Just a simple word. I'm sorry.
Just a simple word. I'm sorry.
People must say sorry. A newspaper headline reads, Van Schoor pleads not guilty to charges.
I think a lot of white South Africans feel a lot like Louis Van Schoor. It wasn't us, it was the system. We were all complicit. Absolutely, we were all complicit. I think that we only know a small percentage of the killings that occurred in this country. And the terrifying thing is, time marches on. People who hold the truth in their minds, who know, are dying. You know, the longer we wait, the harder it'll be to have that truth revealed.
Van Schoor outside his house in his wheelchair. He's shirtless and is looking down at his stumps.
He's nothing,
Van Schoor. He's just like apartheid. He's a ghost of the past.
He's a ghost of the past.
Rolling hills sitting below a grey, cloudy sky. The BBC contacted the South African police with the allegations in this film. They did not respond to our request for comment in time for broadcast. Louis Van Schoor remains a free man. More than 30 of his killings are still classified as justifiable homicides.
World of Secrets tells the story of the apartheid killer. You can listen now. You can find them on BBC Sounds.